Welcome to Empower Your Life with the Enneagram with Dr. David Daniels, the program that will develop your own self-awareness and strengthen relationships with all of those around you. Now, enlightening you with the Enneagram, here's Dr. David Daniels.
Hello, this is David Daniels, the host of the Bringing the Enneagram to Life show here on Voice America. And I want to just review briefly for new listeners what the Enneagram is. Ennea is just simply the Greek word for nine, and gram means a figure or something drawn. So it's about nine personality styles that describe how we feel and how we act in the world. And it's a very powerful way of understanding our personalities because it gets right down to the basic motivation in our lives. And when we get down to the basic motivation in our lives, it gives us a lot of fuel to help us in our change, in our work of personal and self-development. And it also defines or describes the way our attention gets oriented, the attentional stance we have, the perceptual filters for our heads, our hearts, and our bodies. And we all have a different set of these, and so we're different from each other in this particular regard. The Enneagram helps us see how we operate in the world, and we also can come to understand how other people operate in the world and come to a better sense of appreciation and acceptance. Well, today we're going to the third of the three mental types. Remember, there's three basic intelligence the Enneagram honors all three of. The first is the head center of intelligence, the mind. We all know about this in Western life because that's where our educational system is based. But there's also a huge intelligence of the heart, as people like Daniel Goleman have pointed out, an emotional intelligence. And there's an intelligence of the body and of instinctual life, of knowing from our kinesthetic system, you know, where power is and where control is and whether things are comfortable in the way they should be. But today we're back in the mental center in type 7, which we call the epicure. It can sometimes be called also the adventurer. And in the epicure, just to give the basic structure of this type, is that when we start out in the beginning in the essential state, it's like the little infant can even kind of travel in its rudimentary way the spectrum of consciousness and hold its concentration on one thing at a time, almost in any direction. So this is why a little infant or a little child, when they skin their knee, all that attention goes there, and they holler, and you don't know at first whether they've broken their whole leg or been crushed or whatever. 2 minutes later, they may be happy and running around. Or they can put their attention onto a leaf or some small thing and move it around because they can go through the whole spectrum of things. But this is a child who comes to experience a lot of pain and frustration, of course we all do, and limitation, but comes to the conclusion you can escape this. You somehow can escape pain. You believe that you can keep life up, keep it up and flowing and happy and positive, and you don't have to, you know, get stuck in any kind of pain or suffering. Subsequently, you tend to organize your whole life in this direction, and there's a sort of a gluttony of the mind. It's a driving energy under there, a kind of gluttonous energy to interconnect and interrelate things. It's an associative mind. And it just pours out with ideas and possibilities, and the tension goes to options and opportunities. What I like to say sometimes is planning for pleasurable, positive possibilities. And you believe in this, and you'll just keep life flowing and up, and you have one adventure after another. Now, of course, you don't realize that what you aren't seeing and what you're actually missing out on is that there's a whole spectrum of life where there's more pain or suffering or sorrow that you're not even experiencing because you're off planning in the future, and you're not so much in the moment with things. All of this is designed to avoid or protect you from going into so much pain, which you believe is possible, or suffering, that you might never come out of it. And the trap is, I can keep life up and flowing all the time. And the cost, as I was just mentioning, is that, well, you're not right there in the present moment, and you're not there in the whole spectrum of life, and the whole of what love has to offer, and the whole range from joy to sorrow. And to really know joy, of course, we also have to know some sorrow. So what does this bring up for you? And I'd like to introduce our panel. We have Sally and Hanley David today. What does this bring up to you about the key themes of your type 7, the epicure? David?
I just remembered as you were speaking, David, of finishing up my PhD at Northwestern University and not knowing what I was going to do next. And looked up on the bulletin board, and they had a job possibility at the University of New Brunswick in Canada. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I wonder where that is. So I went and got a map and looked at it, and I said, hey, I bet that'd be fun. So I applied for the job and got it and stayed there for 6 years. And it was fun. But I've always had this sort of adventurous spirit and seeking to just find the next interesting, fun thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So what made you go to New Brunswick and stay all that length of time, though? I mean, not made you go there. I mean, it looked like a new, interesting, but you stayed there for 6 years.
It was. I'm an entrepreneur by heart, also starting up new things and getting them rolling. I'm not so interested in the day-to-day administration once they're going, but I love to get them up and get them running. And I had the opportunity to build a department of management in the business school, so I got to hire people and design the program, design the courses. And so it was a tremendous challenge. I love challenge. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing. One of the things I love best is going to a place where I don't know anybody and meeting them and finding out what's there.
Right, something new, something adventurous, and something different to keep the mind going and keep things open and keep opportunities flowing. Right, right. How about with you, Hanley?
Well, David, listening to you talk about the basic proposition, the first thing I was listening to about, getting into the suffering and the pain side. And even with all the things I've grown and learning about the Enneagram, what still pops up in my head, well, why would I want to do that? I mean, why would I want to be in that space? And it's still a constant reminder of me, of this power of my type, to even as conscious as I am now about how important it is to really move through those and be into the present, about how there's a very strong propensity to just move away from it. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the ways I've moved away from it...
It again being from pain and suffering?
The it being, moving away from the pain and suffering is a number of ways. One of the ways, to articulate that is the course of my career. I spent the first 20 years of my career inside major companies and organizations, and I never had a job that anybody ever had before. So every job I had was a new department or a new position that was either created for me or, in most cases, where I created it for myself. I'd do that job for a couple of years. It would be just creating this wonderful new thing, and then all of a sudden I'd have employees, and things would get hard, and I'd move off to the next job. And so I was able to manage a career very much where I got to have a lot of fun. And yet there were points in time, and it finally came where I had to stick some things out, and I really became challenged by some of the problems that I had literally been avoiding for a long time in my career. And it was very difficult and very challenging me to finally face those things.
Right. What would be an example of a problem you finally came and had to face?
Well, one of the things that I managed to do was to keep finding a way to work for bosses who I had really good relationships with. And in one case, that was true for about the first 6 months, then my boss moved on. And I wound up working for somebody who I just was not having a good relationship with. And there was really a need to be in some very direct and somewhat painful confrontation with this person because I was not ready to leave. It was not my time to do that, and I had a lot to done. And it was costly for me for about 6 months where I just continually just avoided and would find and create incredibly good reasons, very good at rationalizing reasons for not engaging around this painful confrontation till finally it happened. And what I remember about that is I'm proud that it didn't happen particularly well, but I'm pretty proud that it happened at all. Mm-hmm. So and it turned out, and it was a great learning for me, that the fantasy of how bad that was that I carried inside of me was so much greater than the reality of
right,
what it
that
really
it would
was.
Really get you down in some way. That
yes,
there should be some awful.
I fantasize that very rich imagination that creates wonderful things can also create that as very awful. So it turned out not to be anywhere near as big a deal as I
right.
had made out of it.
Right. That you didn't want to, you know, the whole thing is like, I want to get into these new things, and I want to keep things flowing, I want to keep them up because I don't want to get stuck in anything that's going to be really painful for a length of time.
That's absolutely right.
Right.
Yes.
That's the so you got to keep moving and find new opportunities and
yes, exactly.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Great imagination.
And actually, and developed a skill set that I was good at it. Mm-hmm. So it was a good way to, in a way, skip over the top of a
rock. Well, what happens when you get in a, you know, you get into the middle of something and you have to slog your way through it? You know, like most jobs, you know, have the grunt work or the gopher work or whatever. What happens then?
Well, you know, I think that there was a time where that was I was always the last one behind on my expenses. I mean, there was a lot of the matter of fact, I used to call it, I had my own pet title. I used to call it gerbil work. I used to call it the part of my job that I'd rather teach a gerbil to do. And it was the sort of the very repetitive tasks and all that. And there was a time where that used to actually get me in trouble. And it was always, when I was inside companies, I'd get these very high marks for creating things and for making major things happen and get these really low marks around administrating my organization and being late on performance reviews and that kind of stuff. And but after a while, I just learned that I had to evolve out of that.
Right.
So today, I'm willing to, and it's still willing. It's never going to be easy for me to do that stuff, but it's more as a force of some discipline and will, and perhaps a little maturity that at least I understand the importance of completing.
Well, and
that.
Perhaps also, you know, at some other level, realizing that this isn't truly limiting your life. That what's limiting your life is avoiding things that are actually necessary to do
yeah.
to have freedom.
Exactly right. You know, I guess one of the things I've learned is that not doing it is so much harder than doing it. Where I'm confronting or doing, the amount of energy I put into making up reasons and or rationalizing, you know, just to avoid doing it actually requires a lot more thought and angst and energy than actually just tackling it head on.
Right. Sally, how about yourself? How do you know you're a seven or epicure?
Well, I think a big part of knowing that I'm a seven is the optimism, the sense of adventure, like was mentioned. I have this knowledge that even if things get really boring, I can change them. Even if I just do it mentally, I can switch things in my head. I think, though, as time goes on and as you get older as a type 7, you come to the realization that you're, well, like you said, you're almost making yourself miserable with the adventure. You're spending so much energy doing it that you're not really accomplishing anything, and you're frustrating yourself in doing it. And
well, the irony is too, if you're avoiding, you know, the grunt work or what the gerbil work, if you're avoiding it, people start to eventually get on your case, and they start putting limitation on you, paradoxically, which you hate to have. Do you have that experience?
I don't have that much trouble with that. I don't like people telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. I always have a better idea, and I do, and better idea than my boss, better idea than anybody.
Your so big smile there, like you always have the better idea.
I do. And so what I usually try to do is fly under the radar and then, you know, kind of produce this big thing, you know, and say, look how this works.
Right.
And,
so what's the matter with being told what to do?
It feels very limiting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I don't like to change my mind or, you know, sometimes luckily, I'm in a job where there's a lot of brainstorming, a lot of very humane type. I'm working with volunteers. I'm working for a hospice, and so a lot of what we do is try to make people feel better. And we come up with some incredible ideas. You know, if people aren't treating the people in some of the palliative care units aren't treating the volunteers right. Well, how do we approach this? And so we got this big idea. We'll bring them bagels and tell them thank you for treating our volunteers so well. So there's a lot of creativity in moving in different directions.
You know, you also bring something up I think is very important about the type. You work in a hospice situation where people are suffering or people are dying. And you sevens actually cannot work and bring new ideas, bring optimism into the situation, see how you can treat these people well. It's not infrequent to see sevens and tops that look on the surface like, my goodness, why would you be there?
That's what I asked myself for a long time. What am I doing here? But it is the optimism. It is, you know, I think that if you find even that moment of brightness, bringing something, is it, you know, and I guess when we talk about, when I talk about hospice, everybody thinks it's about death, but really it's about life. And I think that was the attraction for me, that there are the, maybe you don't have long to live, but you can really live well in a very short amount of time.
Right.
And I experienced that because I lost my husband to cancer. And I think that was a big changing point in my life as a type 7, because at that point I found purpose mm-hmm. in doing something, where before it was like having a lot of fun and having a lot of fun and being miserable, but then, you know, really finding a way to make a difference. And I think that's hard for a type 7. And amazingly, we can make a huge difference.
Right. And sort of like, I don't know if this was the experience, but when your husband's illness came on you, that kind of brings you into the present, into that there's some limitation on what his lifespan, and you want to be with him.
Yes, it was very much being in the present moment. And as a type 7, I know I'm always like light years ahead of where I should be, or in a like some kind of fantasy realm. I can be off in my head and people will be talking to me, and I'm just not. My father is a type 7 too, and I remember as a child saying something, trying to get something across, and he was just absent. And unless you're real dazzling, you know, you don't get the attention. And if you're really dazzling, then you get everybody's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I did a lot of, you know, moving fast and then feeling kind of like a charlatan. And, you know, now I know I'm a charlatan, so it's not a problem. But
now, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, for when I was younger, it would be like, who am I? What do I like? I like everything. I'll go here, I'll go there. I can't pin myself to one particular thing. I'll be really interested in one thing, then I'll be off on another.
Right, and you know, from the outside, that can seem like escapism.
Yeah.
From the inside, well, I can have another good new idea, a new plan.
And it connects. Everything connects.
And everything connects.
You know, if you were in my head, you would see the connections. But right. It's so fast and it's so moving. I mean, moving so fast and changeable. So there is an aspect of the type 7 that I think is definitely a charlatan. You know, we can charm our way through a lot of situations. And sometimes that's not necessarily bad. Now I realize when I'm doing it, like sometimes I'll be talking to someone, like I was doing some online dating and meeting people, and, you know, you talk and then there's a pause. And, you know, I know how to make it better, but, you know, and start the conversation again. But one thing I realized that really amazed me was I wasn't necessarily doing it for the other person. It was uncomfortable, and so I was doing it for me.
Right.
I like to pretend I was doing
the
it.
The charming, disarming aspect is so you can keep things bright
but
and
But it wasn't
cheerful.
So much his pain I was worried about. It was
right.
more mine.
Right. Mm-hmm. So one of the things about 7 that, or the Epicure that said, is that it tends to be a pretty self-referencing style, because if you're going to keep life up and keep it really buoyant and keep it moving, you have to reference to yourself. You have to be a little bit on the narcissistic side, because if you feel dependent too much on anything else, you know, it's hard to keep things up and flowing. Could you comment on this aspect of mm-hmm. the 7 style?
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of myself in what we're talking about right here. Sally just made a very interesting point about purpose. True story, I was standing in line as a college freshman, and back then you had to declare a major. And so I'm standing in this line, and I'm just gripped with existential anxiety. I have no idea what I'm going to tell this professor at the end of the line, about three people down. So I put this guy behind me. I said, what are you going to major in? He said, oh, I did some research, chemical engineering. I make a lot of money. So I literally go up and sign up for chemical engineering. I don't even like chemistry. So obviously that didn't last very long, but it told me that I really didn't know who I was and what I wanted to do.
What was primary? I mean, exactly. you could sign for 20 different majors.
Right. And so I became interested in life purpose, and actually I've developed a seminar, which I've taught for about 20 years to executives, students, anybody that wants to know, where I actually help them get in touch with their purpose, because I was looking outside myself for my purpose. And I realized, because the second thing happened, I became a math major as an undergraduate, went to work for NASA as an aerospace engineer, and I'm sitting there making lots of money, working overtime, and not having any fun. It wasn't very much fun. So I said, gee, I wonder what I could do. And this guy next to me said, you should go get an MBA, because with an MBA and a technical undergraduate degree, you can do a lot of different things. I said, okay, fine. So again, I let...
Sounds like another good idea.
Another good idea. I let somebody else tell me what my purpose was. So that led me to this whole development of the purpose workshop. But as I look back on my life, I see that what Sally's saying is true. I was married to my childhood sweetheart. I got sent to Vietnam in the Army, and while I was gone, she had numerous affairs, which I found out about when I came back, and it was really painful because we were very close and we were very devoted to each other. So we got therapy and counseling, but she kept doing it, and so I eventually had to divorce her, and it was enormously painful for me. And I didn't like the pain, but I did go through it. And I see chapters of my life that unfolded such that when things got really uncomfortable, I would create something that allowed me to move on. And so now that I'm more aware of this pattern, I'm in a situation right now where there is a uncomfortable person that I'm working for. He's a wonderful person, but he's got some qualities and attributes that I find difficult. He's a perfectionist. And the one thing seven isn't is a perfectionist, or at least my kind of seven. And so I've just forced myself basically to stay in there to learn what I can learn from him, right, viewing it as a growth opportunity,
right,
for me.
Because his seven will see, this is the one. We haven't gotten to that yet in the series.
Okay.
But it will, the one in its perfectionism or its judgment will tend to make it feel like there's limitation.
Absolutely.
You've got to do it this way. There's a right way to do this, and that feels not good at all to the
he
seven.
He does this all the time. But yet I can see his wonderful qualities. He's a very principled man, a lot of integrity, really cares about the program. He cares about me. He always tells me he loves my enthusiasm, my creativity, and so forth. But I drive him crazy because I'm not as interested in the details as he is. So we have this wonderful dance that we do together, and we can talk about it, and it's very healthy. But I can see that I'm choosing to stay where I don't need this job. And a couple of times I thought, man, I'm going to ditch this. That was my feeling. But I said, no, I'm going to come to that.
Right. Good. So, Henley, what about this whole issue of what we call narcissism or the self-referencing aspect?
Well, here's a way it showed up all over my life for a long time, and it still does it. I can't help myself, it seems. I don't have ideas. I have great ideas. I mean, I'll go into a meeting, and I won't say, listen, I have an idea to share with you folks. I'll say, I got this great idea that you're going to love. And people would react differently like that, but it took me a long time to get that, until actually one time when somebody actually said to me, said, what makes you think the idea is so great? And what went off in my head is, well, I had it.
Right, I had it. I'm the guy with great ideas.
I'm the guy with the great ideas. What do you mean? Why don't I think? So I think it's this notion at a deeper level, what really that tells me is, and early on in my life, I grew up in what I call not a very functional but very crazy family. I mean, people loved each other, was great, but it was a very high conflict, very noisy place where my strategy for that was escape. And my escape was not physical at first, but my escape was this escape into my own mind. So much of the early fun and optimism that I created amidst this real world that was kind of frightening to me.
Right, so that it was really useful and important and vital that you have this sort of self-reference, and you could go to your own mind and your own ideas and your own interrelating of things.
It was the safest place for me to be. and specifically in my childhood. And that became a very, and as I occupied that world, it became a very ornate, very rich world, and in which I played out ideas all within my mind. And in that rich world of my mind, I fell in love with that world. And that world is in my own mind. And I can't think of anything that gets you more self-referencing than that particular phenomenon of sort of being in love with what's going on
right.
in your mind.
That's great. What a great example. I want to move on to and ask Sally about another topic, but related is like, you know, for all of us, for all the types, no matter what we are, some things set us off, get us into personal reactivity, push our buttons, so to speak. What will get you into reactivity? What will put your push your buttons?
The one thing that will always push my buttons are people who are stuck in negativity. People who just love to see the bad side or what's missing. People who my kids always tell this story when they were young. They could say anything. I didn't care, you know, what words they used. It didn't bother me. They could never say, I can't. Because that one phrase to me was the most limiting thing that you could ever do to yourself. And there's always a way, you know, in my mind, there's always a way to do things. There are ways to pull yourself out of problems. And I just have a very hard time with people who just stay there.
Right. So people stay and get stuck in something. It's like that's limitation.
And yes.
Limitation is going to cause reactivity.
Well, and it's limiting me, too. You know, I wouldn't care, you know, probably wouldn't care if it didn't somehow bring me into it.
Right. And you don't want to go down what might be the path, at least somewhere believed in, where you'd get limited.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you might get stuck in something, in suffering. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm very quick to, I'm very quick to change the situation just like that.
Right.
Somebody goes, this is an awkward pause. I'll go, oh, there's nothing wrong with pauses. Or, you know, it happens so instantaneously. I almost don't see it until after it's done.
Right, right. So, David, what'll push your button, set you off?
People telling me what to do.
Mm-hmm. Same thing, that limitation
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, and the specifically the perfectionist idea, I've gotten so I can laugh about it now. My wife, when I do dishes, will watch me, and I can see that she's thinking that I'm not doing them well enough. But for the longest time, it irritated me to be watched and to be corrected and to be told how to do the dishes, you know, because I'm not a child. I can do the dishes. But it's being told what to do. It's being limited, like mm-hmm. you say. That's what it is.
Because ultimately, that could just drag you down and get you sort of buried in the mundane or
yeah.
or suffering or something.
Something like that.
I don't want to be watched.
I don't want to be watched.
Right.
I've got a real autonomous independent streak.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And if I step on that, I'm going to hear a response.
You're going to hear about it.
That's right. Hanley, what about you and what will set you off?
I think there's a lot of things. But I think the thing is when people rain on my parade, and I'm thinking plans. When I plan something, it's always, there's some reality in it, but, you know, there's a lot of icing on my cakes when I plan things. And what other people perceive as injecting a little reality into what I'm doing, I see as negativity. So I sort of had to work out that their sense of reality is mine. So it really, when I'm, I think the phrase that I detest most in the world is yes, but. When somebody says yes, but, mm-hmm. I know what's coming is they're going to knock it down or they're going to do something to it. And already I'm defensive and really prepared to not listen as well.
Uh-huh, right. Well, thank you for that. I want to move on to the topic of relationship.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to speak a little bit. What are the positive things you bring to relationship?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Sally, would you start with that? Or what do you...
I think in many ways, type 7 personalities are very open to a lot of things. we don't like conflict. We don't like to get angry, and want to make everything okay. So in many ways, we can keep a relationship up. I know as a parent, my kids loved it because it was like, oh, an adventure, go, you know, do whatever. And they're very successful. They're very, they've explored a lot in their lives, and they enjoy that. I think what the bad part in relationships is we do tend to be absent a lot. We're right with ourselves all the time, and we're just so scintillating that, you know, we stay with ourselves rather than really looking at what the other person needs or thinks.
And like coming back and getting really grounded and being present for the person when you have these brilliant ideas and you want this and right. Sort of, it's like with all of us, it's like the opposite of the same. You know, the positive qualities also are the challenges or the negative side. So it's like being present in to the other person or to
it's
the
very
people.
Hard to be present.
Right, right. And relationship, David?
I'm told by my wife that she loves my enthusiasm, my spontaneity, my love of adventure, my willingness to try new things, my willingness to extend myself to other people. I love doing that. I love connecting with other people. So I bring all of that, but I also bring sometimes impatience, sometimes impulsiveness. I can be impulsive. I can make a decision very quickly without analyzing all the consequences, whereas another type would be more sober about it. I just go with my gut.
Yeah, it's fast mind. It's quick. There's lots of things going on, right?
Yeah, I've got a very fast mind. So I can see the pros and cons of what I bring to a relationship.
Right. And the cons have more to do with, like, slowing down a little, being present for the other person, you know, expanding your patience.
Yes.
You know, actually even getting more down into your own heart energy, you know, and connecting at that level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that I am increasingly enjoying doing, mm-hmm. connecting right. at the heart level. But my habit of mind in the past has been, like you say, it's been entertaining, sort of like Hanley was saying, the entertaining play of my mind and all the possibilities that I can think of and
right.
create.
All the fascinating possibilities.
Oh, there's a ton of them.
Right.
And I've looked at most of them.
Hanley, in relationship, what do you bring to it and what are the challenges?
Well, I think one of the things, if I talk about the, you know, my relationship with my spouse, which I think has just been and continues to be absolutely wonderful, a wonderful, scenic, and bumpy road is the way I describe it for many.
You wouldn't
many
want
years.
A smooth highway, right?
Yeah, not a smooth highway, but it's been pretty wonderful. And if I describe the thing that I brought to it is we have had a lot of wonderful the adventure. We've had a lot of wonderful adventures. We take very different kinds of vacations, and just recently we wanted to do an Alaskan cruise, so we wound up doing it in a really small boat with just a few people and exploring places where nobody else goes, and that was my idea. I just sort of came, let's not do it the way everybody else does it. And we've gone to see a lot of things in the world, and it's something that my spouse really enjoys, and so I brought a lot of adventure. The other thing is that And I'm a very loving person. I really love her. I love the people in my life. And I actually find a lot of creative ways to express it. One of the things that I did for years and years and years with a group of our closest friends is on my birthday, I cook a lot. I do a lot of cooking, and I make dinner for everybody. And so there's just a way that as part of...
And you do the dishes?
What's that?
And you do the
I dinner. Won't go near doing the dishes. No.
But I can see this is like Julia Child's kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stuff all over the place.
No doubt about it. So I think that, you know, there's this... so there's that. But I do bring a lot of creativity in that. And again, you know, just like Sally and and David were both saying, you know, there is this part that at times I have trouble seeing who's really there. I'm seeing so much of my own thing to see through that, to really touch the other person, is I can get lost in the moment. And of all the argument, you know, all the other stuff which we sort of worked out, I think that that's at one level. But those are really poignantly painful moments in a relationship where I'm just simply not there because I'm so much in myself.
Right.
And that's been a real challenge to become more conscious.
That's the big challenge. And so that the other person actually experiences the love that's there.
Yeah.
But it has to be experienced. And to be experienced, you have to come back more into the present moment and be there with what the person's feeling and thinking. And sometimes that's painful.
That is painful.
And staying with that.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge.
Yes.
You know, do you really care about me?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, I want to ask you each, you know, what has the Enneagram brought to your life? How has it been helpful or beneficial?
You
can start with David.
I'll go with that one. It's been enormously helpful. Helping me understand my own pattern, but I think even more importantly, it's helped me to understand my wife. And there would be things that would happen in our relationship which I would create a lot of pain in myself about, thinking she was trying to hurt me. But what I now realize is that she's operating from her habit of mind, just like I operate from mine. And so it's developed a lot of compassion in me, which wasn't there before, a lot of understanding. It's easier for me to communicate with people that are different from me now because I know how they structure their reality and I can communicate with them more emphatically. Like, for example, my boss I was talking about earlier. I know exactly what will make him feel more comfortable. So if I go in there and say something to him that I know will make him feel more comfortable, that's helpful in our relationship.
Right.
So it's been... it's been a great source of opening my eyes to how I am in the world and how I can be more effective in dealing with other people.
Actually, seeing the other person's point of view and being able to accommodate to it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's been very helpful.
Right.
David, I have been personally and professionally involved in human potential for going on over 30 years now. And the Enneagram has been a part of my life for about the last 3 or 4 years. So what it's done for me better than anything I've come across is it's provided me with a structure and a language that is so beautiful and so complete in which to conduct myself and specifically in the relationships in my life. Because I think at the end of the day, my work is my work, and I'll figure out ways to always get it done. But what's just incredibly important to me at this stage of my life is the relationships I have, my loving close ones and my friends and all that. And there's a way that the Enneagram has given me some very precise and accurate ways to look at hard things to look at, and also as a seven, there's a way that I've been able to legitimate me looking at my own pain with a little bit more courage than perhaps in the past.
It's like what you're saying is that it's not like dampening down the positive and the great ideas and the wonderment of the positive, but it's completing life by allowing others in, their point of view, even the pain and suffering, to make life whole.
That's absolutely right.
And seeing their point of view.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
You know,
right.
Sometimes, you know, sevens, when they start, like, I don't want to be stifled. But it's not about stifling, actually. It's about ultimately enriching.
Yeah.
Paradoxically. So how about yourself, Sally? How's the Enneagram benefited your life or come into it?
Well, it has allowed me to slow down and to really be at peace with where I'm at and to recognize when I'm off and running again, when I'm doing, you know, when I realize, oh, I'm doing this again. I found that I need so much less. All the things that I thought I needed before I still have adventures, of course, but I don't feel this driving need that I used to have all the time to find something and not even know what it was, or to think, oh, when I get this, this will be better, or or, you know, where I'm going to be in the future. A lot of that I don't even think about anymore. And part of it is still being the type 7 because it's still the experiment. It's still the ability to go, oh, I wonder what would happen if this, and then wait and see. And I think
I wanted to add in there, because it's so relevant to what you're saying, and then you can go on, is that what you're talking about is coming back more into the present, the sort of simplifying of things. Is what we call in the language like the sobriety. It's like coming back to the present moment, to what's really here, to being conscious to the other and to oneself. And it's like reclaiming that quality.
Yes, and and like work before, but I've come to the realization that it's a lot more work just trying to keep everything moving and juggling and making myself happy, when all I have to do is hold back and it's all there anyway. And it's better than I could have dreamed up.
And for everyone, for all of us, this all requires a better self-observer, to be able to come awaken and to observe. And that's the path that we talk about always in the Enneagram, is sort of the path of liberation, that you have to see and experience, you know, how we work before we're going to really change it and make it different. Just briefly, from each of you, how can others support your life? Just in a sentence or two, if you could. It's a limitation, but if you can.
Yeah, I could say that people can lovingly give me feedback when I am being eccentric, when I'm being flamboyant in a situation where it's not appropriate, when I have grandiose ideas that might not fit a situation. If it's done lovingly, yet pointedly, I really appreciate it.
Good. Thank you.
I think that, you know, somewhat in the same tone of what Dave is talking about is when people get to know me and see sort of through some of my own self-fascination to who I really am, and can see my heart and respond to that and reach out to me there. That's just incredibly meaningful and helpful to me.
Right, and to tell you, I want to be up on your screen. I want you to be up on your screen as you always are, but I want to be up on it too, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And Sally?
Well, I think a lot of patience is needed for, you know, the people who are dealing with type 7s, because, you know, we do get way ahead of ourselves and everything else. I find that I really like when I know I've been of help to someone. And sometimes it's not, anything big. Like, I don't like a lot of drama or, you know, awards or anything. It's like when I'm doing things with coworkers, and if I help them out, and it's like, oh, great, we got this done. I mean, that's like the icing on the cake for me. I like being part of a team. I like everything on an equal playing field where we're all working together towards something, right, or achieving something together.
Thank you. It's time to ask our audience for questions of the panel.
Hello. My name's Lorraine, and I had a question about if we would have something scarce or difficult to talk with you about, what would be the best way to approach you?
I find that I don't mind talking about difficult stuff. I actually enjoy working with my feelings now more than I ever have. So I guess I like to be helpful, like Sally was saying. I love it when people ask me to help them with something. And it pulls me out of myself. So it's actually very satisfying. I enjoy that.
This might sound counterintuitive, but be as direct as you can with me, because I sense indirectness and become suspicious of it very quickly, because I already know when it's difficult. I mean, one of the things as a seven that I've developed is incredibly good sensibilities and sensitivities to when something negative is coming. So I can put up this big positive defensive shield, you know, pretty early. So what I find is when people are just, and I tend to do that when people are beating around the bush and sort of flustering about it more. But when I know that I've got a trusting relationship and somebody just comes up and says, I've got something to tell you, well, just be as direct as you're comfortable with being. That tends to really be very supportive with me.
We have time for one more question, and I'd like Sally to field that, if you would, Sally, and then we need to bring closure.
Hi, Sally. I'm Wally, and my question is about confrontation. I would like to know what emotions are you feeling when you have someone come up to you that's strong and is confronting you? Is it, do you flight or do you stand there and fight? What emotions does that bring up?
I think it would depend. I have a very strong eight wing, and if I'm definitely confronted, I can go there very quickly. From a seven position, I don't mind confrontation, but I can get pretty slippery about it. And I always, when I'm type seven, always try to avoid confrontation or conflict. I work at, you know, not so much appeasing, but changing the situation so everything becomes an even playing field.
Right, it's
again.
Like you're the masters of reframing.
Yes, yeah, right. And I can explain very well why it you know, why this will work out, because, you know, and if that's not, if I see that's not working, I can shift to something else. And so I guess it would just depend on the confrontation.
We haven't gotten to the program yet on type 8, the protector, but it's the type that has the most ease in confronting situations. Well, we need to bring this session to a close, and I want to thank all of you for participating and just briefly summarize that this is the style of keeping the world up, keeping it flowing, keeping things happy, and partly that's a protection against, you know, getting into too much suffering or pain or being pulled down in the world and getting embedded or stuck in suffering. But part of it also is this great talent to see what's possible in the world and to interrelate and interconnect things. It's a great gift in that sense. So as with all the types, there's a huge blessing inside the type, and there's also a struggle or something we're trying to avoid in our coping strategy. But thank you all for being here today, David and Hanley and Sally. Next week, we'll be moving to the heart center of intelligence, and we'll be starting with type 3, the performer or achiever. And we look forward to the listening audience being back then for that program.
Thank you for listening to Empower Your Life with the Enneagram. Join us every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time for another informative hour of Empower Your Life with the Enneagram, right here on the network truly dedicated to your health. Voice America, Health and Wellness.
What is this wonderful and effective self-help system known as the Enneagram? The Enneagram tells us why we feel, think, and behave the way we do. And most importantly, it tells us how to become the best self in all domains of life. We introduce the Trifold School of Enneagram Studies. Our training program has the highest standards in its field, with remarkable records of trained, skilled teachers. The Trifold School of Enneagram Studies includes the Enneagram Professional Training Program, business training, consulting, classes in the integration of psychology and spiritual life. For more information about our products, training, and classes, go online to www.AuthenticEnneagram.com or call 1-866-366-8973. Empower your life today with the Enneagram.